Hello, I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. In the last episode of Undisclosed, on the testimony of one, we heard about the many new witnesses who came forward to contradict the lone eyewitness who put Terrence Lewis at the scene of the crime and away for life, and why those witnesses might not matter. And with us today are Colin Miller, who is one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's also an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hello, Colin.
Hey, John. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Also joining us is David Harris. He's the John E. Murray Faculty Scholar and Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's also the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast, which discusses current issues in the American criminal justice system. Now, sadly, David, I have not been fortunate enough to listen to the Criminal Injustice Podcast. So can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. And it's good to be with both you and Colin. The Criminal Injustice Podcast, we do long-form interviews with people who are important actors in the system, be they office holders or former office holders, thinkers, practitioners, cops, judges, lawyers, people who have been convicted and had their convictions reversed. We cover the entire waterfront of the many issues in our criminal justice, or as many say, injustice system. We also do stories periodically about lawyers behaving badly. That's one of our features. And we have a call-in feature. We ask people to call in and ask Dave, that would be me, any question they want about the system or something they heard on the program. So we've begun our fifth season as of the other day, and very happy to have kicked it off with a feature on sentinel event analysis. This is the kind of thing they do in the aviation industry and in medicine. Why don't we do it in criminal justice when we have our version of catastrophes?
Well, the big reason is we don't understand what that means. What does that mean?
Good point. The idea is to look for the systemic explanation for why mistakes happen and keep happening. We look for people to blame sometimes. We deflect blame. We do a lot of blaming, but we don't look for the systemic idea. What is it that goes wrong that allows these mistakes to keep getting made, and how can we fix it? Forget about blame. Let's fix it going forward. So that was a very interesting discussion with Jim Doyle, an attorney who does a lot of work with the Quattrone Center there in Philadelphia and in Boston. And our next episode coming up next Tuesday will feature Ryan King of the Urban Institute. And he's going to talk about why our prison populations are actually so large, not because so much of drug cases or short sentences, but because of exceedingly long sentences, the kind that we don't really want to talk about reforming.
So now you've heard the last few episodes of Undisclosed. Do you have any thoughts on Terrence Lewis's case?
Well, I just love this podcast. It is so great. And this is another terrific chapter for the Undisclosed podcast. What's so striking here, I mean, if you step away and look at the big picture, is that Terrence has a finding of actual innocence by a court, and yet it's not enough to free him. He is more tangled almost because of that in the system and in the failures of the system than he would be without it, because he was sentenced as a juvenile life without parole defendant. He'd be getting a sentence review pretty soon. Maybe he'd even be out. But because his case has been done so badly and a judge has found him innocent, he is actually still there and might remain there longer because of that. It's so contradictory. This is the kind of thing that people who are not members, if you will, or trained in criminal justice as a lawyer or somebody like that, they look at this and they go, how can this be? And the great thing about these three episodes about Terrence is it's showing us how tangled our system can get and how out of proportion our reactions sometimes are.
Well, and later on in the podcast, we'll actually get into pretty deeply the procedure versus substance argument in court. But what struck me about this case, and this is my first time on an addendum since we started it, was that it's a single witness case and that on the basis of one single witness who, you know, has admitted issues with reliability. You know, there were all kinds of conflicts in her testimony. Plus, you know, it's clear she's a habitual drug user and was using at the time of the crime. I was just trying to rack my brain and try to think, okay, how does a prosecutor decide that that is the only witness they're going to put on and to rest their whole case on that? Pretty much. I mean, obviously, they put on other witnesses that were, you know, that were the crime scene investigators and the police officers involved and such like that. But the only one tying the actual suspect, Terrence, to it was Starr, this one witness. But I started wondering what could cause a jury to find her persuasive.
We can talk about the jury, of course, but really the mistakes and the problems come in at the level of police and prosecutors. The reason we have a one witness case is not because there was only one witness. That was the one thing you really saw in spades in episodes 2 and 3 of this one. There are plenty of witnesses. It's just that our system, the actors in it, whether it's because they're overburdened or don't do their jobs well, whatever it is, they did not go out and really investigate the case thoroughly enough to see what was really there. They were satisfied with the easiest answers, even though there was plenty more out there to find. That's why the jury ends up presented with this very weak, we can see now, one witness case. And it's easy for us to say in a certain respect, you know, well, you know, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they see through that? Well, this is all that the state gave them. And that's the real shame of it.
But I do have a theory as to why she might have been considered persuasive. And that's because I served on a jury at one point, and there was a witness who had a speech impediment. He was also a habitual drug user. And it was fascinating because it did cause two interesting dynamics to come into play for the jury. One, he was a stutterer, and he was trying so hard to overcome his impediment and speak clearly and articulately that just the effort of doing that put the jury on his side. There's a certain amount of empathy that you feel for somebody who's clearly trying. And even though there were flaws in his testimony, there was an immediate empathy, which I found fascinating. Also, I was curious, Colin, in this case, was Starr romantically linked with the victim, Bernard Howard?
Yes, she was. Bernard Howard was a widower, and Lena Laws Starr had been in a romantic relationship with him for the past few years before this incident occurred.
So I think that also may have played into the empathy of the jury. You have, a woman who sees the man she loves gunned down in front of her, and I think that would up the bar of disbelief. In other words, a jury would feel like, in order to disbelieve her, they would have to emotionally overcome a lot of bias toward empathy in that situation. And another thing that I think might have played into the dynamic is often when somebody speaks with a speech impediment and has some difficulty speaking in court, people hesitate to ask them questions that they might have. I mean, it might explain why in the transcript it seemed like the questions contradicting her were somewhat perfunctory, or it sounded like Susan was saying that she felt like they did follow up on the contradictions in her testimony, but they just didn't land for some reason. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's true. They definitely could have been more aggressive on cross-examination. And then I think there's two other factors at play. One, the way we look at eyewitness identification testimony now is a lot different than it was back in the 90s. And so I think the jury would put a lot more credence back then than they do now. And the other thing is, you know, Lena Laws Starr says these three young men were selling drugs out of this house over the summer. I saw them, you know, upwards of 50 times every day or so selling these drugs. And without really a defense witness to contradict that, that's pretty credible. I mean, maybe she got some details about the shooting wrong, but she is pretty straightforward on the witness stand and saying, I know these three young men. They've been there all summer. I would be able to identify them. And they were the three young men who were there that night.
So, David, as you mentioned, there were clearly many witnesses to this thing. Well, what does it say about the police and also obviously the defense attorneys in this case that nobody found these people or brought them to the authorities' attention at the time?
Well, I think it says that there is either a lack of effort or a lack of resources and likely some combination of both. We all know that our police and particularly our defense lawyers are overstressed. They don't have the time, the money, the resources to investigate thoroughly, and that can lead sometimes to things being left uninvestigated. And we also, when we work like that constantly over the long haul, we can develop bad habits. We don't actually go and unturn the other stone. We don't look a little harder. We don't try to push that last particular lead. And therefore, we can, you know, we just build up bad habits. And I would credit that kind of explanation for what we saw here. I mean, these people were out there. They could be found. And they were, in fact, found. It just came way too late. And because there's that kind of flabbiness or laziness or lack of resources in the system, one can only wonder how often this kind of thing happens, because Terrence can't be the only one who suffered because of it.
This is a case, it's not a public defender. It was a highly respected attorney who represented Terrence. And this is similar to what we saw in the Adnan Syed case. The facts aren't exactly the same, but this is an attorney who, after this conviction, submitted an affidavit, a statement where he said, I was sick, I was ill at the time of representation, and I didn't necessarily realize it at the time, but at least for Kizzy Baker, the first street witness who said, I saw the three men who entered the house and Terrence Lewis wasn't one of them, she lived on that street, and very easily the attorney could have, just by knocking on doors or making calls, located her. And he didn't. And he recognized after the fact, I was ill. I was not up to par and I made a mistake.
Have you guys made any overtures to actually speak with any of the police involved? I know on every case that you guys have investigated, most of the time you've been stonewalled by the authorities. Have you tried that in this case?
Yes. Located numbers, email addresses for all the detectives, police officers have made calls, sent emails, and the response has either been nothing, or we wouldn't be able to take part in the podcast.
Now, we talked a lot about the corroboration requirement for criminal prosecutions. Susan gave the example of treason, which has a corroboration requirement. What other cases involve corroboration requirements?
It's really pretty uncommon, John. I mean, the system in general does not require corroboration. In other words, one strong witness, strong enough to persuade the jury beyond a reasonable doubt, is considered to be enough. You have a checkered history with some of corroboration. It used to be that in certain kinds of cases, sexual offenses, in the distant past, the evidence wasn't considered good unless there was some kind of corroboration. But now that thing has generally faded away, thank God, in the area of sexual offenses. But generally speaking, it's not required. The one that I could think of, the one example where we do usually have corroboration requirements, is in the area of accomplice liability. If an accomplice is testifying against another person who is involved, courts generally require some corroboration. It's not all going to be able to be pinned on the testimony of the accomplice, because the law recognizes that by nature, accomplice testimony is unreliable. It has certain built-in problems with it. This person is obviously trying to save his own or her own skin. That is also true, of course, in lots of other types of individual cases. But as a general matter, the law doesn't require corroboration. It's the rarer thing.
And the podcast was talking about literally the biblical precedents for that kind of thing. Has that always been that way? Did American law reflect what you're saying, that it's very rare, or did it originally have those kind of things built into it?
I think a lot of old systems did have corroboration problems or issues built into them, but anymore, it's a thing of the past. You really rarely see it except in that large area of accomplice liability. It's not very common.
Yeah, there's an old doctrine, corpus delicti, and that translates to the body of the crime, and it's been misinterpreted to say you needed to find a body to prosecute someone for murder. In fact, what it was way back in the common law days, centuries ago, it was to say if you had a confession by a defendant, there had to be corroboration to support that confession. In fact, that's actually probably something that's good based upon all the false confession cases.
That's right. That's exactly right.
But as David notes, really, it is a checkered history because, you know, out of all the crimes, robbery, burglary, arson, etc., it was rape and child molestation that had these corroboration requirements. And it was based upon this flawed view that women mainly were likelier to falsely report rapes or child molestation. And therefore, the legal system said we need corroboration for their claims. Now, obviously, that is a vestige of an older time and that has been removed. But I think the problem is, I think there are cases out there that could benefit from a corroboration requirement. But I think based upon that checkered history, it's unlikely we're going to see that anytime in the near future.
Are there any that jump out at you as like an obvious thing for a corroboration requirement?
Oh, anything involving a jailhouse informant, I'd like to see corroboration of that. I mean, that testimony has proven over and over in so many cases for years and years and years to be so unreliable. And we just know it. We know that that testimony is not always wrong, but we know that there are huge reliability problems in that area. I would like to see a corroboration requirement for those witnesses, if nothing else.
And I would personally say eyewitness identification and especially cross-racial identification. Maryland a few years ago banned the death penalty, but before they did, they had a law that said a conviction for murder in a capital case, at least, cannot rely solely upon an uncorroborated eyewitness identification. And so maybe some type of corroboration requirement where you only have a person who's not familiar with the defendant who's identifying them, I think that could benefit many cases.
So I had a couple of questions about the supposed accomplices to Terrence, Jamar Gladden and Jamel Lawson. It seems that Jamar has admitted to some degree that he was there, but has he committed to any culpability in the crime?
Well, if he was there and he was the one who was emptying out people's pockets, correct?
He was, although his claim is I wasn't acting in concert with the other two, sort of. I came to the house because I was paged. When I got there, these two other men were already there at the house. And I did ask for money because Star owed this drug debt to me. I'd given her some drugs previously.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So his claim is I wasn't acting in concert to these two men, one of whom shot and killed Bernard Howard.
Yes.
What is Jamel Lawson's status in terms of what he has admitted to, what he's been convicted of? And by the way, are Jamar and Jamel also still incarcerated?
Yes, they are both incarcerated. Jamar is appealing his conviction on the ground that he arrived separately and says he was not acting in concert with the two men who were involved with the murder. Jamel, as we sort of reported on the episode, he says that he never sold drugs with Terrence Lewis. He's not aware of Terrence Lewis ever selling drugs, hadn't met him until the first day of trial. I'm not sure if he has any current appeals. We don't really have anything beyond that statement he gave where he said, I met Terrence Lewis the first day of trial and hadn't met him previously.
So my question being that it seemed like the new evidence from the new witnesses contradicts that JR and Jamel Lawson were even involved. Or it's difficult to tell because there's somebody walking away at one point and that might have been JR. But it was unclear to me from the new witness statements whether they seemed to, that the two guys who we believe were somehow involved, whether even they were or innocent or not.
Yeah, I think that is a question. There obviously are these contradictory accounts. I think one of the men, it was maybe Keith Christian, if I have that right, or Horace Timmons, says that one of the men who entered was Naeem or Naeem, which was another nickname for one of the young men. So that would corroborate him being involved. So certainly Jamar Gladden says, I was there. Jamel Lawson, there might be some question as to whether he was involved or not.
You noted, actually, that Terrence Lewis's attorney and Jamar Gladden's attorney entered stipulations that there was going to be character witnesses on their behalf testifying to their good behavior, but neither of them actually testified. Why would a defense attorney make that choice?
Well, character witnesses, I mean, we see that a lot on TV and in the movies, but it's actually not that common to see them in court. I mean, they come forward, they're there. But they have a limited impact. I think that's fair to say. I mean, I can count the number of times I presented character witnesses for my clients on one hand. And I'm not saying they didn't have a good character. I'm just saying, for the most part, they don't do a lot to move the jury one way or the other. The idea being that if you have friends, if you have people who are in your life, you can probably find somebody to come to court and say something about your character. What I remember is that both of them had multiple character witnesses and their lawyers stipulated to that. They didn't even present one. Now, that's what surprised me. They stipulated that they would present 12 witnesses and they'd all say that these guys had great characters. That did strike me as a little bit odd. If you're going to go to the trouble, why not present at least one or maybe two if the court will allow it? The court isn't going to allow 12 character witnesses. It was in any case, it would just be considered a waste of time, probably.
But I imagine that's a judgment call for the defense attorneys involved, because they may have felt that the state's presented evidence was so weak that it wasn't necessary. I mean, that's the only justification I can think of.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, that they were just kind of gambling. We don't really have to do anything here. We're just going to wait and let the case collapse of its own weight. The jury is never going to convict on the little evidence that we've heard. So that may have been what they were thinking.
This is a case, too, where there was this affidavit submitted by Terrence's trial counsel. And in that affidavit, he said, I'm aware Terrence Lewis did not have a criminal record. He was a student. He was working multiple jobs at the time of trial. And again, he acknowledged he messed up. He said, this is a case where absolutely I should have called one or more character witnesses. And as David notes, it is rare, and it's rare because many defendants either have criminal convictions or at least some type of criminal history or reputation. And Terrence Lewis didn't. He had no contact with the criminal justice system. And this is just another instance of the attorney saying, I screwed up. I should have had character witnesses. I didn't. And yeah, stipulation, as weak as David noted a character witness in court can be, a stipulation is simply, as we reported on the episode, it is a document that's read to the jury that says we have these witnesses who would have testified that he has a reputation for being peaceful and law-abiding. Well, that's even weaker than having a relative, a neighbor, a friend coming in and just explaining to the jury, look, I've known this person and I can describe that this person has a good character.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things with character witnesses, when a person does have a dark background, has had some arrests or some encounters with the law, the cross-examination is so easy. Mr. or Ms. Character Witness, were you aware that the defendant was convicted of this, that the defendant has a record for that? And you get a lot of leeway in that cross-examination because the purpose of it is to show the jury that this character witness is either really not aware of the character to which he or she is testifying or is just kind of giving a party line. So you wouldn't do it in a lot of cases because of that. But here with a person like Terrence, I mean, for God's sake, try it once or twice at least.
And he was 17 years old when the crime occurred?
Yes, he was a juvenile.
Mm-hmm. So I assume he was still in high school at that time?
Yeah, I think, well, this was August 96. And so I guess it would have been in between. So I think he was a junior the year before. So I think he was a rising senior at Overbrook High School.
Yeah, he was still at the high school. That's where they got his ID picture from for the photo arrays.
Ugh, that's just brutal. That this 17-year-old kid, and we're seeing that this was probably from the basis of the Crime Stoppers tip. That's the only bridge to Terrence that we have in terms of what we understand from the investigation. Correct, Colin?
Yeah, this is another case, again, like the Adnan Syed case, where we find out after the fact there's apparently a Crime Stoppers tip, and we have no idea who called this tip in, if they were given a reward, what their basis of information was. We have no idea how this investigation got to Terrence Lewis. All we know is we have these four or five witnesses who say we were all there that night, plus his accomplices, his alleged accomplices, and they're all saying he wasn't involved.
Interestingly, the Crime Stopper tip included Jamar as well as Terrence, and it said that one of them went south, or it's a little unclear from the notation whether they're referring to Jamar or to Terrence. Do we have any knowledge of whether Jamar actually did go south?
Yeah, I don't know about that. That is something we are trying to research among other facts in the case, but yeah, we don't know.
I'm just suggesting that it may be a key to finding out who, you know, somebody who would have that particular knowledge. That might be a key as to how the Crime Stoppers tip actually came in. David, I had a question for you about, obviously, how juveniles are treated under the criminal justice system changes over time because of how we perceive kids. You know, what is the history of how the government looks at and treats juvenile crime in the United States?
That's a great question, John. You know, it goes back to the early part of the 20th century when there were reformers looking at various parts of social life in cities in the United States. A lot of lower class, working class people, a lot of immigrants in those places. And the criminal justice system was just grinding people up, including kids. Kids were just treated like small adults. And one of the chief reforms to come out of that area was juvenile court and juvenile justice. The idea was kids are different. They are not small adults. There is the possibility, as a kid grows up and matures, there's a possibility always for change and reform, a possibility to turn that life around. And the juvenile justice system was created first, I believe, in Chicago to recognize that, to treat kids differently, to say, okay, you've committed what for an adult would be a crime, but we recognize a lower degree of responsibility and a greater possibility for growth and redemption. That's the system that caught on and swept the country. And pretty much by the middle of the 20th century, you had juvenile courts almost everywhere. People in juvenile courts, these minors, are not even referred to as defendants. They're referred to as juveniles or something like that. They are not public hearings. They are generally closed. And they are not even considered to be adjudicating crime. It's an adjudication of delinquency. By the time you get into the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, there's a greater emphasis on putting due process protections in place in those places because the judge was simply tasked with finding out the best interest of the child, the best interest of the minor, and that didn't provide enough legal protection in some cases. By the time we get into the 70s and 80s, lawyers are there, it's part of the system, but it's still a separate justice system, and you can't hold a kid past, say, age 18 or 21, I think it's 21 in most places, for a sentence for a crime that they did when they were a juvenile. When we hit the 90s, something changes. The 90s crime wave, you've probably heard the term super predator that was kicked around in the 90s, came up in the last presidential election. This was a term during the Clinton years for the idea that kids, juveniles, were more involved in crime, that crime was much more violent, and these kids had no remorse, they couldn't be saved or reformed. And so we get backsliding on this whole idea that you can redeem kids, that you can expect change and growth in them, and you have many more kids, juveniles, who would have gone through the juvenile system, now they're transferred into the adult system. They go through adult trials, and they go into adult court and into adult prisons. One of the things that arises during this period is juvenile life without parole. That had existed some before the 90s, but it really came into full flower in the 90s, and you get hundreds of kids around the country, thousands of them total, but hundreds just in Pennsylvania, sentenced to these very long life without parole sentences as kids for things that was done as juveniles. We hit the 2000s, and again, things start to change back toward the other direction. The Supreme Court changes the law in a series of cases to recognize where we started, which is that kids are different. Kids don't have the maturity, they don't have the judgment, and now we have neuroscience that tells us the physical brain and the capacity in the brain for those kinds of things is simply not developed sometimes into the early 20s. And so now we've got Supreme Court cases that say juveniles can't be subject to the death penalty, juveniles can't be sentenced to life without parole or to the death penalty for non-homicide crimes. And then the crucial cases for our case here with Terrence have to do with life without parole sentences, where the Supreme Court says at last you cannot have mandatory life without parole sentences. That's the full scope of the juvenile system, and it touches directly on Terrence's case.
Do you think that invariably, you know, the tone is set by the Supreme Court, and then it sort of sweeps across the nation with the states sort of interpreting it individually? Do you think we'll ever hit a time when juvenile life without parole is just is out of the question in all states?
Colin can correct me on this, but I think it's over half the states now, or roughly half the states, where that sentence for juveniles has been outlawed. And I think things are clearly moving in that direction. Pennsylvania has not gone all the way there. They have, in one of their recent cases just this past summer, the Batts case, said that life without parole sentences for juveniles are presumptively unconstitutional. Not all the way unconstitutional, but it has to be the kind of extreme case where you see evidence that this person, though they are young, simply cannot be redeemed. As the Supreme Court has said, the U.S. Supreme Court, that's going to be a rare, rare thing, but Pennsylvania still clings to that. And it's, in a certain way, it's not a surprise. You know, everybody likes to be number one, And here we are in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was clearly number one for juvenile without parole sentences. I mean, it was just a shameful, shameful thing. We had 600 people with those sentences at one point, 300 of them out of Philadelphia alone. So now that's where Pennsylvania is. Other states are much further along. They've abolished the juvenile life without parole sentence altogether.
One thing I noticed is that I believe is an interesting overlap to the super predator mythology that arose in the 90s was the lead paint issues that we now understand that lead paint actually exposure to it in young people can often cause violent behavior, lead poisoning. And to me, I feel like my theory has always been that the super predator mythos arose out of the sort of last vestiges of the lead paint poisoning era, when lead paint was gradually phased out of paints, because people have been trying to figure out why crime rates are plummeting, you know, and it's been attributed to broken windows policing and all kinds of things. But I wonder if anybody's taken a real epidemiological look at it.
I think they have, and I think that the evidence is worth considering, but what I recall is that it would be really, really hard to draw that that knot of causation around it. I don't think that could be decisively proven. There would be other things in the mix, as you say, perhaps demographics more than anything else. Crime turns out to be a young person's game, and when you have a big bulge in the demographic population in the crime-prone years, crime is going to go up. And the form of that crime, maybe it's more violent, that may have more to do with the form that crack markets have taken in that very same period of time than anything else.
Or a confluence of all those things.
Yeah. And there's the controversial argument, the book Freakonomics, where they say,
yeah, there you go,
it's Roe versus Wade, and the right to abortion and the women having those abortions leads to the drop in the crime rate. Now, of course, there's pushback to that, and there's studies that find the opposite. But yeah, there's leaded paint, leaded gasoline, there's abortion, there is the drug epidemic. And all these sort of different factors, it's tough to disaggregate. But yeah, I mean, for whatever reason, we have this myth of the super predator in the 90s. And as David so well illustrated, that leads to not only more juveniles being prosecuted as adults and given life without parole sentences, but it also, of course, leads to the AEDPA, that federal act that is the other big thing in Terrence's case as to why his actual innocence is not leading to his release.
Absolutely. And that is a really key thing. You know, the focus on the AEPDA, the Anti-Effective Death Penalty Act. Let's see if I got that right. AEDPS. That's it.
Anti-terrorist.
Thank you very much. Right. This law was enacted in no small measure because of the super predator idea and because there was this frustration that federal judges were getting into death penalty cases, coming out of the states and monkeying around with them and preventing the death penalty from being carried out. And, you know, we see this incredible tangle of procedural versus substance, innocence versus other things. This was actually the goal of that law, not this particular tangle, but to stop courts from getting into these cases and reviewing them. What we're seeing in Terrence's case is not a mistake that it arises out of the AEDPA. It is the intended effect. And that is, I mean, that's just beyond depressing to me. It's one of those things that we should look at, just like the super predator idea, and say that idea was wrong when we did it, and it's high time to get rid of it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the procedure versus substance argument that I wanted to get into, because, you know, it seems to the lay listener that, you know, so often we have court cases decided on procedural grounds when the substance is glaringly clear. Why does the court system give those things equal weight, if I may ask?
Wow, what a question.
Sorry.
No.
You're going to get hit with the big ones today.
No, it's a great question.
Welcome to Undisclosed.
No, it's a great question, and I want to just make a bow here to my students who, when they hear procedure versus substance, you know, their eyes just glaze over, and not without reason. You know, somebody said a thousand years ago, the history of procedure is the history of justice. We have to have procedures to have our system run and run fairly and run in a way that makes some degree of sense. But when procedure overwhelms justice, when it is used to keep people from getting justice, that's when the hair on the back of my neck stands up. That's when I think this isn't right. And that's when any layperson says, you know, WTF, what is this? I mean, how can this be that you have one judge finding, here's a finding of actual innocence, and then all these procedural things keep the person in jail and actually make it more difficult for that case to be heard and heard fairly. I mean, we need procedures. Procedures are important for a system to work and work systematically. But when they become the end in itself, and when they are used as ways to become barriers to real justice, I've got a problem with that, and I think everybody should.
And in general, the only people empowered to change these sort of things are prosecutors and judges. Am I correct?
Well, Congress could, for instance, get rid of the AEDPA tomorrow. It won't, but it could. So a lot of our procedural law comes out of the federal rules of criminal procedure, the federal rules of this, that, or the other, and then they come out of court decisions. So a lot of it is made at the legislative level, and then the judiciary puts its own gloss on them. And yes, they could do things to untangle, but what they're doing mostly day to day in the court system is they're dealing with what's there, with the cards that are already on the table. So we have to think sort of bigger than any particular case. We have to ask ourselves, where are we going to find actual justice and actual truth? The idea that actual innocence is not a ground for appeal in any system seems to me to be a wrong fit with the world we live in now, with DNA, with the investigation being done, not just by prosecutors, but by undisclosed, by any number of conviction review units. This is something that does not fit where we are now.
To your knowledge, has there been any exploration of amending the AEDPA? Has anybody tried to futz with it to maybe not do that? I mean, as you said, it's not a bug, it's a feature, but if this is the kind of thing that it's wrought, has anybody attempted to turn that around?
There have been attempts. There have, you know, people have written articles and made proposals and so forth. But, we're in a time now where it's difficult to get the Congress to pass the federal budget for a 1 month period. We've kind of lost our ability to solve difficult problems like this. So I'm not looking for it anytime soon. I think you could find a lot of people in the Congress and certainly on the bench who recognize that this is a big problem and is not serving justice. But it's hard for me to envision how we get this law changed, at least in the current climate. Colin may feel different about that.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, a lot of people in the media have reported on the folly of this act. There are certainly Congress people out there who would like to reform it, but there's just not any real traction in Congress right now. It's so low on any list of priorities. You're not likely to see anytime in the near future any meaningful change to this act.
So, David, here's another big question for you.
Let me have it.
Yes. So you talked about the Alton Logan case on your podcast.
Yes.
Which we talked about on our show because in the context of Terrence Lewis's supposed accomplices told their attorneys at the start of the trial that he wasn't at the crime scene and that he was actually innocent. But his attorney did not reveal that information. And the same thing happened in the Alton Logan case. In fact, he remained silent for 26 years. Where do you fall on that ethical dilemma?
Well, there are ethical rules that attorneys have to follow. They are sworn to follow. And defense attorneys owe their allegiance not to some vague idea of overall justice, which that does obligate prosecutors. But defense attorneys serve that one client. They are for that person and that person alone. In the context of that relationship, they have certain obligations. They have the obligation of confidentiality. They must keep everything said to them within the attorney-client relationship, with some limited exceptions, must keep it confidential. And number two, they got to serve the client's best interest. Now, the problem in Alton Logan's case was when these other people told their lawyers, Alton Logan didn't do it. I did it. All right. Another guy told his lawyers that he had done the crime. The problem there was, number one, confidentiality. And number two, if the lawyers were to come forward, it would put the crime that Alton Logan was accused of around the other guy's neck, and it would be coming from his lawyer. All right. So that was their dilemma. And I understood that. And I think it's, you know, that they see their role and they see their obligations and they took an oath. I think it's possible to come out on it very differently, though. I think a person could say, look, yes, I have an oath. Yes, it may get me disbarred. But how can I stand by while somebody sits in jail for a crime they didn't commit, while that person sits in jail for 26 years? And I think some lawyers would say, look, I'm just going to be civilly disobedient. If I get disbarred, I get disbarred. The real issue comes on whether you're willing to make the information public if it also hurts your client. And in Alton Logan's case, they made it public, but only after their client died and with their client's prior permission. So if in Terrence's case, this information comes from one of the other guys, and that other guy would give permission for that information to come out, you got to ask, does it put that other person in jeopardy? That's the real issue. And the other fellow's attorney said in Alton Logan's case, we're not going to do that. We're not even going to ask him to do that because it would hang a murder charge on him, and that can't be us doing that. So it's a very difficult dilemma. I'd like to think I would always err on the side of justice, but here you see justice in a certain respect can be seen to be on both sides. Interestingly, Alton Logan, the guy who sat in jail for 26 years, he doesn't blame the lawyers. He doesn't say it's their fault. He says the other actual killer should have come forward. He puts it on them.
Well, that is the person who started the whole thing going. You know, I was wondering if maybe there's a workaround, like there's some way for attorneys to alert, say, you know, a conviction review unit, sort of a third party. Obviously, there's no guarantee that that information won't get out. But perhaps there's some kind of mechanism that can be put into place, considering that now, you know, a lot of states are instituting these kind of things. Perhaps there's some workaround.
Colin, doesn't Massachusetts have a new provision on this?
Well, Massachusetts has had it for a while, going back to the time that this confession came out, that says we have an exception to attorney-client confidentiality. If you are told information as an attorney that would establish a wrongful conviction or execution, you are allowed to disclose that. And Alaska has one of these exceptions too. So those exist, and that would allow full disclosure in those states. Beyond that, I don't know. I think, John, your idea of maybe having something to the conviction integrity unit could work. I think there might be a solution where maybe the attorney could file something under seal with the judge and in camera outside the presence of anyone else. The attorney could disclose what he's been told, but you just have to think there's some way that an attorney should be able to voice this and ensure that a person who's innocent is not sitting in jail for 2.5 decades like Alton Logan.
Absolutely. And I mean, I would go with the cleaner solution. I'd go with Massachusetts and Alaska, and I'd say, look, there's just an exception to this. If there's a situation where somebody is suffering in jail or might even be executed, that's different. I do remember that in Alton Logan's case, the attorneys for the man who admitted it said, well, we wouldn't have allowed him to be executed. We would have come forward then. So even they had in their minds, there was a line that they wouldn't cross.
Interesting. But incarceration, and I've been to one jail, or rather one prison in Canada, which, you know, I'm sure it's a very different prison system. But incarceration in and of itself is horrible and horrendous. And in many respects, you know, that's an odd, and I understand why they would make that exception for themselves and for their own, so they can sleep at night. But being incarcerated for 20 plus years is torture by itself.
Absolutely. I don't disagree with you on that. And, you know, if you have some kind of a life without parole sentence, you're basically going to die in there. That's a slow death. It's not a fast death. Some people will even argue that that could be worse than simply being executed.
So another thing I wanted to bring up is that there's actually been some very interesting stuff in the news lately. Some big news out of Philadelphia. As you know, there's a new district attorney in town, Larry Krasner. And I remember seeing the tweet about it. He just up and dismissed 31 members of the district attorney's office in his first week in office. I mean, obviously, whenever new governments come in, there's often a purge. But this sounds like a kind of a big deal.
I think it is a big deal, but not an unexpected one. I mean, the old saying, John, is the new broom sweeps clean. And if you look at the numbers, I mean, there are over 500 people in that office. So 31 is between 5 and 10%. It wouldn't be at all unusual for a new DA, whoever they are, to come in and change over all of the managerial and supervisory positions and so forth. But remember that Kramer ran in a very specific way to change the culture and change what that office had been doing for so long. That office, as we know, was responsible for 300 of the 600 plus juvenile life without parole sentences. They were responsible for an overwhelming number of the death sentences in Pennsylvania. It has had a culture of heavy penalizing, of all kinds of other things for a long time, and he ran against that culture. So it would not be at all surprising for him to go even deeper and to get rid of anybody who is sort of connected at any high level with the last regime or somebody who is fully bought into the old regime and might not be able to go forward. So not surprising in that way. One of the interesting things I picked up in some of the chatter is that one of the people who has been terminated actually headed up the conviction review board or conviction review unit in the DA's office under the prior DA. And one of the things that Krasner has been most pointed about is that he wants to invigorate that process and really make it work like the Brooklyn DA's office or other places like that and not have the district attorney kind of pulling back on it, as it were, but going forward in a very forceful way, which he thinks is necessary. And so that connects directly into Terrence's case. I mean, Terrence's best shot, if you ask me, or at least one of his best shots, is going to be to get his case in front of a new conviction review unit and to have it reviewed by those people, to have them know, look, there's been a finding that this guy is actually innocent. Look at all these new witnesses. That unit will not be bound necessarily by all the procedural tangles that we've been talking about. And that could actually crack this thing open and get it to a resolution faster than anything else. So the most significant thing is that Krasner himself is coming, that he's changing the culture, and that he may even be changing it most pointedly at the conviction review level.
Yeah, and that's definitely exciting. I'll have an interview with the new head of the CRU, and actually we've presented them with new evidence in Terrence's case, and we're hopeful as to the result that can lead to. But certainly that change at the conviction review unit is something that is exciting to us given the cases we're working on out of Philadelphia.
I think the challenge for Larry Krasner is huge. I come from New York City, you know, and Philly is very similar in that there is an entrenched police culture, you know, for good or ill, you know, and he's fighting an upstream battle. And I wish him luck. You know, I hope that this is just the first step, but he's got a minefield to walk through, and I hope he makes it through okay.
Well, he's an interesting example of a new trend. We have seen new DAs elected in a lot of places, people you wouldn't expect to be DAs in places you would not expect these types of people to be. I think of Kim Fox in Chicago. I think of now two DAs in Dallas, Kim Ogg in Houston, Ken Thompson, the late first new DA in Brooklyn, now followed on by another new DA. And this isn't an accident. I mean, I think people are realizing how much power the DA has. And that was something that people just didn't give a lot of thought to in the past, that the prosecutor has an immense amount of power as to how the criminal justice system works in individual cases and in sweeping terms. And they are seeing this, and they are turning out people that they don't like. So Krasner does, I agree with you, have to be careful, and he really does need to take it slow, and he needs to make a strong effort to get people on board with him, to convince them that he's not trying to turn the DA's office into the, you know, the People's Republic of Philadelphia DA or something like that. Because, that, you know, his background was as a defense and civil rights attorney. So they're not going to come in liking him. He's got to win them over. He's got to put a lot of effort into that. But make no mistake, he won the election based on that. That's what people wanted. It's what they expect. And I, you know, I don't see him backing away from that. What he has to do is to take it in a direction where it can succeed.
Another piece of interesting stuff that I saw in the media this week was an article by Lara Bezalon in Slate.
Yes,
called The Innocence Deniers, which was a kind of harrowing look at some prosecutors across the country that have seemed to latch onto particular cases and refuse to admit the innocence of the people who are, by, you know, every possible measure, been proven innocent, either through DNA or other people confessing for their crimes or any number of things. It was a fascinating article. And as I said, kind of harrowing, because you just have to feel for the people caught in this kind of a nightmare. But unfortunately, it didn't, because, you know, some of these folks didn't cooperate with her article. It didn't give much of an insight into why. But it was interesting that it crossed all boundaries. It was progressive prosecutors. It was, you know, old school conservative ones. It was, you know, black people, white people. It didn't matter that they all in this article had seemed to latch onto a case against all, you know, contrary evidence. Do you have any thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, I thought it was a very interesting article. I'd recommend everybody take a look at it. You know, it's human nature not to want to admit your mistakes. Let's just start there. Nobody really likes to do that. And you really have to learn to do that. And you figure out as you go through life that, you know, that's actually a good idea. When you're a public official and you're committed to something as important as the guilt or innocence of a particular person or the success or failure of a prosecution, and you put a lot of marbles in it and it's all very public, for a lot of people, it becomes very difficult to back down from that. And that's why I think you see it crossing all kinds of lines. It's not any particular type of prosecutor. Anybody can get real invested in a particular case to the point that they're just not willing to back off. And it's very unfortunate. I mean, one of the great innovations of the last few years has been conviction review units. And now we're, you know, new one now in Philly and ones in Chicago and Dallas and Houston and the other places I mentioned. But those things are internal. Don't forget, that is internal to the office. And the office and its head will decide what happens in any individual case. So it's not an independent body. So if that particular DA latches onto that case and says, hell no, I don't care what the evidence says, we're going to stick with this, and I don't admit we made a mistake, that's the way it'll stay. It would be good to have outside, real independent review that would come to these cases. That is the case in some places, but it takes a different kind of body than a conviction review unit to really force the hand of the DA to let go of some of these things. It's, you know, what it reminded me of in a slightly different way in Terrence's case is in episode 3, they were talking about the fact that the resentenced juvenile lifers without parole, they were being offered a deal. Here's your deal. Plead guilty and we'll make you eligible for parole after 35 years. Wow, there's a great deal. And, you know, just an unwillingness to let go and say enough, enough, enough. And a lot of times, people get so stuck into what they believe and what they've done and the ways that they've looked at something that they feel that personally or politically or whatever, they just can't admit that a mistake was made and a different road has to be gone down.
Yeah, that's my personal theory on Thiru Vignaraj's insistence on being involved in the Adnan Syed case. And he's recently revealed that he's running for office. I think that may have had something to do with it. Because,
oh, you think? Yeah.
Yeah. because, you know, I feel like when you know, the evidence at this point has fallen apart to such a degree that even if in your gut you still feel that Adnan had done it, you can't stand by the case anymore. You just can't. But, at any rate, he's trying everything he possibly can. He was even acting pro bono, even though he wasn't with the office. He was handling the case pro bono for a while, which is just amazing to me. Now, we do have some listener questions. We've got one from Nicole Baker, and it says, on your episode 2 and related addendum, you mentioned how actual innocence is not grounds for relief. Could that type of evidence be provided to the governor to ask for a pardon? Is there any procedure for this?
The answer to that is yes, it could be provided to the governor. The governor has a power of clemency in every state. Every state has a slightly different set of rules, which may be statutory, may even be constitutional in some states. But that's the kind of thing that would be put in front of the governor, the procedural protections that exist in court, protections, if you want to call them that, wouldn't exist in a clemency setting where you're asking for a commutation or a pardon. The idea is to consider all the facts. So things will come from the prosecutor, things will come from the defense. They can be all matter of different things, what you've done in prison, how you've turned your life around, and of course, the strength or weakness of the evidence.
Yeah, and similar to what we see with presidents with pardons at the end of their term, it's pretty much the same with governors. When you have commutations, they typically come at the end of the governor's term because they don't want the blowback from the electorate if they're still in office or seeking re-election. So yeah, to expect to see that in a case like Terrence Lewis, you would expect to see it probably toward the end of the term of the current governor.
We also got a question from Celeste at the Jury Room blog, and she says, I feel like my job is still on the floor after Monday's episode. Can anything be done at the city level to help remedy the issues concerning the state versus federal problem in Terrence's case? This is beyond frustrating.
Yeah, that's the conviction review unit. That's why that is in place in Philadelphia. And I've actually been looking to another case in Pennsylvania that's not in Philadelphia, and the attorney laments the fact they don't have a conviction review unit. But yeah, that is the best vehicle currently, and certainly with Larry Krasner coming in, to think that the city can overcome these federal procedural issues is to say, look, the CRU, as in the Sean Thomas case, can step in and say, we believe this is a case of innocence, and therefore, despite any procedural headaches we have in the case, we rule that he should be released.
And this from Brooke at Brooke-PodJunkie. She says, I've never heard a case on a podcast that more fully encapsulates everything wrong with our criminal justice system as the current case of Terrence Lewis on Undisclosed. He has been found actually innocent, yet he's still in prison. The Philly CRU needs to right this wrong. As if on cue. She has reiterated exactly what you just said.
Yes, you're here.
Yeah, we've gotten a lot of feedback about this season, and I think it really has struck a chord with listeners. I mean, obviously, we presented other cases that we strongly believe had wrongful convictions, but I think the listeners in hearing the case of Terrence Lewis have really been struck by, A, the absence of evidence against him, and B, all the evidence, the overwhelming evidence of his innocence that's convinced a federal judge to say he's actually innocent. And yeah, it does, really. It sort of is a nice encapsulation of all the issues you've been covering over the years and Undisclosed to say, look, this is a case where you can look at our criminal justice system and just shake your head and wonder, how did we get here where you can say someone is actually innocent and yet he sits in prison? And almost because of his claim of actual innocence, he is denied relief in this resentencing scheme in Pennsylvania, where he should be having his case heard next month. And because of his claim of actual innocence, his case might not be heard for years.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And you know, it is really worth remembering that it looks like there's hope that there will be some relief at the local level, at the level of the Philadelphia DA. I wouldn't want to, you know, curse it or anything by saying that or saying it too often. But that does seem to me the most fruitful avenue. And what that tells you is something very interesting. You know, we often look at the Supreme Court and their pronouncements and the courts of appeals and so forth. We pay a lot of attention to those sorts of things in law school. The real action is with the local actors. And we're seeing that more and more. I mentioned many of these DAs being replaced, people not being satisfied with them. That's where folks should focus their reform energies, frankly. You won't get a criminal justice reform bill out of Congress, I don't think, anytime soon. There are a lot of people pushing for it, some pushing against. You can see criminal justice reform happening all over the country, on the ground, at the local, and even at the state level. And that's an important lesson to draw from all of this.
Well, thank you, David. Do you have any other thoughts on Terrence Lewis's case?
I just think it's so fortunate that there's undisclosed out there, and especially the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Marissa Bluestein, one of my heroes, out there fighting for these people. You know, I just reflect all the time how when I went to law school, the idea that somebody would be in prison but yet be innocent, that somebody would have confessed but yet be innocent, all those things were just non-starters. And here we are, these years later, we know that innocent people are in jail. Terrence happens to be one of them. A court has even found it. I hope that this podcast, among many other efforts, will help to set him free.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you so much, Colin. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks, John.
And folks, if you want to listen to Criminal Injustice and a lot more of David, check it out on your local podcast app. Thank you once again, David, and hopefully our paths will cross again.
I hope so. This has been really, really fun. People can find Criminal Injustice on Apple Podcasts and any other podcast app that they use.
Well, that is it for the addendum this week. If you feel like checking out our website, undisclosed-podcast.com, there is a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that you can make a donation to right there. I am donating all my fees for this series to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them out as well. Their website is innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle at UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I'm going to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, once more for his invaluable research. And I'm going to thank Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media for their audio production. Patrick Cortez composed our fantastic addenda theme. And Methil Telhan is our project manager. Thank you once again, Methil. And I can't wait to talk to you all once again next week.